Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Division for this Tuesday, February 5th. I'm Frank Kornstein, Chair, and we have four bills on the agenda today. And we'll start with House File 58. Welcome to the committee, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 58 is a type of bill that as a legislature and as a legislator wish we never had to bring forward. But House File 58 is a bill that memorializes Joseph Gumm, a correction officer who died in line of duty in 2018. And it designated a portion of Trunk Highway 95 and from I-94 to Trunk Highway 36 as a correction officer's Joseph Gumm Memorial Highway. And it authorizes memorial signs using funds that must come from a non-state sources. And Mr. Chair, it's I'm sure you've been following, everybody's been following this case, going through the media. And I got to meet with the family on the visitation night, and it's heart-wrenching. And so I've asked some of his colleagues to come in, and we have two people that are going to be testifying, two correction officers are going to be testifying here. And one person I've known for many years is Mr. Hilliard. He's a constituent of mine, and I've talked to him many times. And this is one area that we wish we didn't have to talk about, but we do. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Mr. Hilliard.
And Representative Detmer and I just wanted to formally move your bill. It's going to go to the Ways and Means Committee from here. So okay. That motion is on the table.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for our record.
My name is Sergeant John C. Hilliard. Good morning, Chair, and the committee. To the committee, this type of bill, as Representative Detmer had said, we don't want to have to ever be here in front of you again. And if I had my druthers, we wouldn't be here now. But the incident happened, and one of our brothers at a Stillwater Correctional Facility was violently murdered. Our institution has been hurting for the past 7 months. We're trying to heal. We're trying to come together and to fix the things we need to. And a gesture like this from Representative Detmer, and to hear you guys support this, goes a long way in the healing process that we need to do at Stillwater Correctional Facility. It's very important to me that people start to learn, understand, and know the work that we do in these facilities. We do work for not only the state of Minnesota, but the community at large. And what we do is we make the facility safe for people to work in, the inmates to do their time, and to protect the public. And unfortunately, nobody really wants to know what we do in there until something seriously happens. And I've worked here for a quarter of a century, over 25 years, and this is the most horrific thing that has ever happened in my career here at Stillwater. I want to thank you guys for taking the time with this bill and moving it on. And hopefully we can rename that section of road the Joseph Gumm Memorial Highway. It's very important that our people are allowed to heal and to see that other people take on the meaning of what happened that particular day and why we are doing this.
Thank you very much, Officer. I really appreciate your being here, and we share in your sorrow, and we do appreciate all of the work that you do for the people of Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Now I'd like to introduce an officer, Tony Medlin. Tony was a first responder that day. He was one of the first people up to respond to the incident. And thank God we have folks like Tony's. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that there's three Tonys. There's Tony, and Tony, and all three of them responded to this incident. So I don't want to keep any of the Tonys out. But we'll let Tony Medlin speak at this time. Thank you. Okay.
He'll speak on behalf of all the Tonys.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for having us. Thanks
for your name for the record.
My name is Tony Medlin. I work at the Stillwater Correctional Facility. I am started in August of 2004. Joe Gomm is a good friend of mine, co-worker, mentor. And on July 18th at 1:30 in the afternoon, I responded to the staff assault on Joe Gomm. You know, it was the darkest day in the history of our department in this state, and I got to be with Joe when he exited this world. Joe was alone when he should not have been, and that's for another day. But Joe took great pride in his job and serving this department, the community, the public, his fellow officers, and other inmates. Unfortunately, he lost his life doing what he loved. And I couldn't think of a better man to be memorialized in this way, to name that stretch road in his honor and his memory. And it's a road that I take daily to work, and it'd be a road that I would greatly love to see his honor, see his name, and to it would just be a great honor. And I thank you very much for listening today.
And thank you for your testimony and your service, Officer Medlin.
Thank you.
Are there any questions from members of the committee for either testifier or for Representative Detmer? Okay, do you have any closing comments, Representative Detmer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I hope this is the only bill of this type that we have to bring forward this year, and I hope that things like this can be prevented, and as a legislature, we do have a hand in that, and I hope that we can look forward to the future here that making our correction officers a safe place for them to work. And so thank you for hearing this bill, and looking forward to our next committee that this bill is going to be heard in, and I'm sure the Ways and Means is going to send it. What next committee would you think it would go to from Ways and Means?
Representative Detmer, I believe that it would probably just go straight to the floor.
Right to the House floor. Okay.
Fiscal issue with this, so minor one, but it still needs to go back there.
Appreciate it. I'm glad that this bill can stand alone.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
As it should.
Yes.
Well, Representative Detmer, I want to thank you on behalf of the committee. I want to thank the officers and others that have come today to memorialize Officer Gomm, and we share in your sorrow, and we deeply appreciate your service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So with that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 58 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Members, the next bill on the agenda is House File 211. And we'll wait for Representative Schultz to appear. Do we know where is anyone? I think we'll just have to see if Representative Bernardi is available, and our pages and staff will do our best to track down Representative Schultz. Representative Bernardi is here. I think your testifiers are here as well. So we'll move to that bill. Here's Representative Schultz.
I can wait.
I think your bill's probably a little bit more involved, so if you could defer, that would be great. Thank you. We waste no time here in the Transportation Finance and Policy Division. Well, welcome to the committee. It's great to see you. I will move House File 211, and that that bill is on its way to. You're going right to the General Register.
Excellent.
So no fiscal issues here. Welcome to the committee, and I'll move your bill to be referred to the General Register.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair and members, to hear this bill. This House File 211 essentially adds licensed physical therapists to the list of healthcare professionals that can issue a disability parking permit to those with a disability. So I think it makes a lot of sense to have physical therapists involved. They know the capabilities of their clients and patients. And this bill was heard last year with no opposition and bipartisan support. So I'm open for questions. We do have one person here to testify.
Question for the author? Yes, Representative Elkins?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to remark, when I broke my right elbow in a bike accident about a year and a half ago, during my rehabilitation, I would see my orthopedist about once every 3 months and my physical therapist twice a week. And he was in a much better position to tell whether I was, disabled enough to require this kind of a service. I think this just makes a lot of sense.
Thank you for that. Representative Elkins. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz, for bringing this bill forward. I do have a recollection that this was part of our work last year, but then met some opposition on the other side of the street. Have you been able to accommodate the objections on the other side of the street?
I'll defer that to Tom Lehman and see where we're at with our friends in the Senate. I believe you're referring to.
I try not to say that word, but
it's one of those things.
Representative Schultz is
bringing Mr. Lehman here. Please state your name for the record.
Tom Lehman here on behalf of the American Physical Therapy Association Minnesota chapter. Representative Torkelson, this was heard last year in your committee. It was approved unanimously. It was on the agenda in the committee in that other building. On the last day and just didn't get heard. It is scheduled to be heard tomorrow afternoon, though, so it is scheduled to move over there as well. There were no objections last year. It was just a timing issue.
Well, thank you for that. We'll see how it goes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Any other questions for Representative Schultz? Okay, we have a testifier. Please state your name for the record, and we welcome your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Kathleen Picard. I'm a licensed physical therapist and a patient advocate. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in favor of House File 211. This bill, as has been stated, adds physical therapists to the list of providers who can certify that an individual meets the qualifications to be considered disabled for the purposes of disability parking privileges. The others who are on that list are chiropractors, advanced practice nurses, physician assistants, and physicians. The benefit of this bill to the public is improved access for persons who need this service, and reducing unnecessary visits and the costs associated with those visits. So what prompted this legislation? It was our patients. My colleagues started talking about their stories, about patients who asked for the physical therapist that they're seeing to sign off on the certification, and they found out that they couldn't do that. So I heard stories about people who were sent home from the ER with crutches, walkers, canes, and even wheelchairs, and a referral to physical therapy. So when they show up in the physical therapist's office and they figure out, oh, I really need some help, I could use some help with that parking, that disability parking permit, and they have no choice at that point but to go make an appointment, take the time, spend the money, and perhaps even wait. One patient even talked about having to wait 6 weeks to get an appointment to get their certification while they were still working, and their walk from the parking spot to their work area was 20 minutes. In rural areas, we heard from patients who were discharged from hospitals miles away from where they lived. They were sent back to their towns for physical therapy, and the same story. They'd ask for help, and we'd have to say, no, you have to go back, you have to make another visit. And they'd say, wow, that's another tank of gas. That's another trip to that town. I might have to even ask someone to drive me. And that's that person's time as well. So it's time and money. And patients have been confused and frustrated, frankly, about the already high health care costs, especially those costs that are really unnecessary. So this bill is a very simple solution. Adding physical therapists makes sense because we're now being trained at a doctoral level, and we routinely use standardized tests and measures to measure people's mobility, the very thing we're being asked to make judgments about for this service. Many of our patients have us measure their mobility on a regular basis. We look at endurance. We look at the risk for falling. We look for the quality and the safety of walking. So it's really natural that we would be included in this group that would make determinations about the need for disability parking permits. And because patients do see their, or PTs do see their patients on multiple visits, we are in a good position to understand their disability and how it progresses. So we're actually good, really good, at prognosing the end of that disability and how long they would need that parking permit. So I'll remain here at this time to answer questions, but I'll just end with the fact that it makes sense we become an additional point of access for a service many individuals need and want.
Thank you very much, Ms. Picard. Are there any questions of the committee or comments? Yes, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for my ratification, I guess, do the current permits, do they expire? I mean, you're able to say it'll be 6 months and we'll give you one for 6 months or a year. And do they have an expiration date on it so that law enforcement can see that one might be expired?
Ms. Picard.
Sure. There are two kinds of permits, a permanent disability parking and then a temporary disability parking. We'd probably likely be involved in the temporary ones, and they do have expiration dates.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My background is in the asphalt industry, so I've done striping on parking lots and fairly familiar with the ADA compliance laws. And my question is just about, is there any study that's been done on a possible extra stress to those already dedicated parking spots? Or would you assume that there would the same number of people, you know, I'm all for the access of anybody that's disabled to be able to park. But my concern would just be if there's any studies on, are we going to need to, is ADA going to need to change to come into, you know, make more stalls, essentially?
I'm not aware of any studies, but I can tell you last year when this bill was being heard, someone from the Department of Public Safety testified that they don't anticipate any uptick in the number of them, just okay. The place where people can access them.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. Representative Schultz, did you
that does
have
bring
a
up a good point. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With our aging demographics, this committee might want to consider, do we need more disability parking spaces?
Any other questions or comments for Ms. Picard? I just want to add my voice to Representative Elkins. I had some back issues a number of years ago, and I felt it was the miracle workers of the physical therapists that helped me out. And I know that today is, I think, a lobby day for the association, and I've had the pleasure to meet a number of students both today and in past years, and I just want to welcome them and everyone that's here from the association. Here at the hearing and at the Capitol, and we appreciate your work very much, and your advocacy makes a big difference. So thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And thank you for choosing this very helpful and important profession. So is there any further discussion to House File 211? Okay, seeing none, then I renew my motion to have House File 211 re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails.
Thank you.
And before we transition to Representative Bernardi's bill, Representative Petersburg. We will have a motion to approve the minutes from our last meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the approval of the January 13th minutes.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have a motion to approve the January 31st minutes. all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion carries. Thank you. He's a good teacher. He's a good teacher. So now, members, we have House File 462. You're a member of the committee. Did you want to move your bill?
Yes, I would love to move my bill. So I would, Mr. Chair and members, I would like to move my bill number, House File 462, to be re-referred with a recommendation to go to the General Register.
Thank you very much. We have a motion. And Representative Bernard, would you like to just present your bill, go over it? And I understand you have a couple of testifiers as well.
Sure, I definitely do. And okay, so this bill is a bill that was, in most part, contained into the big bill last year that got vetoed. And we're bringing it back this year. It was had bipartisan support last year, and I expected to have bipartisan support again this year. And I believe Representative Koznick was on the bill as well. He just hasn't had time to sign on to it yet. So anyway, the bill contains a number of changes to bicycle traffic regulations provisions that are supported and requested by the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. The goal of the language is to bring the statutes regarding bicycle traffic into alignment with the corresponding statutes regulating vehicle traffic, clarifying certain provisions, and codifying existing practices and strengthen safety measures. Some of the key changes include aligning language in this section with the driving rules of Minnesota Statutes 169.18 to ensure that the regulations related to passing in the section also apply when passing a bicyclist on a shoulder. Clarify certain safety provisions, including these four things: allowing bicycle operators to determine how close to the right-hand curb is safe to ride. Number two, allow bicyclists to go straight from the right-hand turn lane if they are in the left one-third of the lane, which helps signal to oncoming vehicles turning left that they are not intending to turn right. Require them to, the third thing is require bicycles to give an audible, bicycle riders, an audible signal when passing another bicyclist or pedestrian on a bikeway. And then the fourth one is align language on required distance a vehicle must leave when passing a bicycle with the language on vehicle driving rules in Minnesota Statute 169.18 by adding a definition of safe clearance when passing a bicyclist to be either 3 feet or half of the width of a motor vehicle, whichever is greater. So hopefully that gave you enough detail and keeping it high level. My testifiers can dig into more of the detail if you guys have questions. And with that, you can, Mr. Chair, would you like me to proceed with my testifiers, or do you want to pause for questions?
Well, is there discussion of the bill as presented? Representative Bernardi?
Yes, sorry, Mr. Chair. I also have an oral amendment that I would like to get the bill in the form in which I intended.
So let's consider your amendment, and then we can have discussion of the bill in the form that you would like it considered in.
Okay. So what I'd like to move the amendment A19-0011 to House File Number 462 as follows. Page 1, delete lines 10 to 11 and insert page 3, line 18, delete must and strike not impede the normal and reasonable movement of traffic and.
Okay, does everybody understand the amendment? would you want to have Mr. Burris, should we phone a friend here, or do you want testifiers to talk about it?
Yeah, the testifiers. We will have, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, Dorian Greeley here with the Minnesota Bicycle Alliance. I hope I got that
Bicycle
right.
Alliance.
Of Minnesota. I knew that wasn't coming out quite right. To just give a little bit easier explanation of that.
Sure, of course. Mr. Greeley, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dorian Greeley. I'm the Executive Director of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. We're a statewide organization with members in every county and over 200 cities. And as Representative Bernardi said, these changes, for the most part, were included in the Transportation Conference Committee report. They passed out of Representative Renbeck's committee last year with a unanimous vote, and were rolled up into the omnibus bill and vetoed. And just walking through the bill real quickly, to begin with, we've crossed out the word shoulder in the definition of bike lane.
Can you talk about the amendment first?
Oh, yeah, I can talk about the amendment first.
Yeah, Mr. Greeley, let's focus our comments just specifically now on the amendment, and then we can take your broader testimony after that is discussed.
Right. So, subdivision 169.18, subdivision 10, there are provisions for slow-moving. Well, what we wanted to do is take the impeding part out of thou must not ride two abreast, must not impede traffic, and shall ride in a single lane. So, and the reason we wanted to, it got goofed up when we sent it through to have it revised, and must not ride two abreast got taken out. We didn't want to do that, but we wanted to take out the impeding part. And the reason we wanted to take out the impeding part is 169.18 subdivision 10. There are provisions for slow-moving vehicles who cannot keep up with regular flow of traffic, but they do not use the word impede. So a horse and buggy can't keep up with traffic, a farm tractor can't keep up with traffic, or the pedal pub riding around in Stillwater or Minneapolis can't keep up with traffic, and they do not use the word impede. So cyclists riding two abreast, we didn't think should be considered impeding traffic either. So that's our proposed revision. And Mr. Beck has been working on this for a long time. If there's more questions.
Are there questions of Mr. Greeley, Representative Hausman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does seem to me, though, that the amendment we were just handed, which says it moves to amend the amendment, since it says page 3, line 18, and there isn't a page 3, line 18 in that, that's to the original bill.
It's inserting that.
I think we are going to need to call on Mr. Burris at this point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, members. So there's the amendment, the underlying amendment, which is what was distributed in your packets. So that's the A19-0011 amendment. So that made a few changes to the bill as introduced. And then the oral amendment was also distributed in paper form. That's the H0462A1 amendment. So that distributed slash oral amendment would modify the A19-0011 amendment. So what it would do is eliminate two of the instructions that are on the primary amendment that are on 1.10 and 1.11. So those two instructions would disappear, and a new instruction would take its place. So that new instruction that you're seeing that's quoted in the A1 amendment would then be written to modify the original as introduced language of the bill.
Thank you.
Okay, so just to be clear, Mr. Burris, we would not need to take action on the A19-0011 or simply just the A1?
Mr. Chair, you would the question before the committee would be both adoption of the oral amendment or incorporation of the oral amendment and then adoption of the amendment, the A19 amendment as amended.
Okay.
Assuming that the oral is incorporated or adopted.
All right.
Does that
So we do have to do both, but I guess if it's the House research. Oh, yeah, if it's a rhetorical thing.
The A1 amends the 0011.
Correct.
But the A1 on line 1.4 and 1.5 refer to page 3.
That's because this one does.
So what do they refer to in the 0011?
Okay, thanks. Thank you for pointing that out, Representative Hausman. But I'm interested to know if members followed Mr. Grilley's explanation. I think that's the core of this discussion here. Are there any further questions about this? It is a change to our original bill here, so I want to make sure everyone is on board. Representative Bernardi, any final comments before we adopt the A1?
Mr. Chair, do proceed.
Okay. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. So now, Mr. Burris, would we be considering then the
A11 amendment?
011. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the A19-0011 amendment?
Well, I can talk more about that amendment, but what I talked about earlier tells you the form of the bill with that amendment in it, how we want it, so I could get the details of each line, and I will defer to our testifier here, Dorian Grilley, if he thinks anything more specifically needs to be said without.
Mr. Grilley?
I can do this in a minute if that.
Yeah, I mean, procedurally, we want to make sure these amendments are understood and incorporated, and then we can have broader discussion of the bill as Representative Bernardi would like the committee to consider it. So maybe confine any comments to unless there's anything more that needs to be said about the A19-0011, confine your comments to that at this juncture.
You know, I really don't think, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think we need to talk any more about the A19 amendment.
Okay. Then we'll consider that. All those in favor of the A19-0011 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. Now, House File 462, as amended, is in the possession of the committee, and it is in the state that our author would like it considered in. So we can move on, perhaps, Mr. Grilley, with your broader testimony to the bill, and then we can take questions after that.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dorian Grilley. I'm the executive director of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. And sorry that was so confusing. We tried to make
some
amendments.
We're out of practice, Mr. Grilley. Yeah. This is one of our first amended bills. So. Well, we did have the distracted ride.
So as I mentioned before, these changes were in the omnibus bill last year. They passed out of Representative Runbeck's committee and out of the Senate. To begin with, we crossed out the word shoulder in the definition of bike lane because we discovered that driving and riding rules do not apply to bicyclists riding on the shoulder. So in other words, you could pass a bicyclist by less than 3 feet on the shoulder of the road. On the shoulder of the roadway, you can't pass a bicyclist by less than 3 feet on the roadway. So that's just a minor change, but an important one nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And further down in 169.222 subdivision 1, where traffic laws apply, we've added this subdivision applies to a bicycle operating on the shoulder of a roadway, just to make sure. And as mentioned by Representative Bernardi, the changes to 169.18 subdivision 3 are needed to make the passing a bicycle language consistent
with 16918 subdivision 5, which was changed a couple years ago to allow a driver to pass or cross the double yellow line or pass a bicycle in a no-passing zone when it's safe. So the language in subdivision 3 and the language in subdivision 5 were different, and we just wanted to make that consistent. The riding rules change is replacing as far to the right as practicable with as far to the right as the bicycle operator determines is safe. This language came from the National Conference of State Legislatures. Several other states have passed something similar. The practicable language is from the 1970s and is widely interpreted to be as far to the right as possible. And I know I've been pulled over by some police officers and told that. And we have a police officer here to say that's not true. And not allowing where to ride to be at the discretion of the bicyclist, when in fact it is, because there's all those exceptions that are listed right after that. So we feel strongly this is an important clarification, and we are in the business of educating bicyclists, and that's a much easier rule to teach. So the next change, we already talked about the riding two abreast, and I talked about the impede not being part of any other driving regulation. So the last change is to allow bicyclists to ride through a right turn lane without turning right if they are in the leftmost third part of the lane. And bicyclists feel strongly that this practice is safer than the current law that says a bicyclist must, for example, move onto the roadway on a busy county road when riding down the shoulder to get through an intersection, when in fact, you know, it's accepted practice and common practice to ride through the right turn lane and go straight and make it clear that you're doing so. So that's all I have to say. Did you have it?
Why don't I answer questions if they
can? Mr. Beck and I will stand for questions.
Questions for Mr. Grilly or Mr. Beck? Yes, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to the shoulder, I'm just inquiring because I really don't know the answer. Does, by removing the shoulder and giving that description for a shoulder, riding on the shoulder, give more right-of-way to a bicyclist than a pedestrian who would also be walking on that shoulder?
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, I don't think so, but I think that's probably a question for the council here.
Mr. Burris?
But I think...
Wow. Miss Representative Petersburg, this could be a first if you stump Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, what I'm saying is that when you're walking along the shoulder of a road, you aren't requiring traffic to move over by 3 feet or half the distance when you're meeting somebody on this. So in this particular case, you'd be giving, in my opinion, the bicyclist more right of way than you would a pedestrian, and that may be what we want to do. I'm just asking whether or not that's consistent or not with the rules of the road in general, and so I was inquiring about that.
We have Mr. Burris. We also have people from DPS here, but you want to take a crack at it, or should we have the?
I could
take a crack.
Okay.
This is kind of what I do.
Officer Keel.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, I will. But Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kirby Beck. I'm a retired Coon Rapids police officer for 28 years. I've been involved in bike safety and education since the early 80s. I've kind of specialized in this right now. I'm considered an expert witness or bicycle safety standard of care expert. I work with lawsuits and whatnot. It goes back to definitions. Shoulder is not by law part of the roadway, and that's where this comes in. It's part of the highway, which is right-of-way to right-of-way, but it's not part of the roadway. And many of the provisions in 169 have to do with vehicles operating on the roadway. And our concern is if a bicyclist is operating in the shoulder, and trust me, most of us would much rather operate on a shoulder than on the roadway, and I think most motorists would rather have us on the shoulder than the roadway. We just want to have some assurance that when we're on that shoulder, we have the protections of right-of-way. Somebody's coming off a side street, somebody's coming out of a driveway, and normally the person on the roadway would have the right of way in that situation. If because of that little quirk in the law, a crash happens, and now the point comes up, well, you didn't have the right of way because you're operating in the shoulder. So our concern is that cyclists on the shoulder have similar rights of way to that space as they would if they were operating 3 or 4 feet over on the roadway. And this kind of ends the confusion. It's not one of those areas that people normally even think about, but we want to just make sure. So the concern isn't whether we have right-of-way over the pedestrian. It's just we want to make sure we have some rights in the event of bad things happening and clarity.
That's very helpful.
Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that regard, then, why wouldn't we give the same rights of right-of-way to a pedestrian?
I think the biggest difference is speed. A pedestrian can stop within one step. A bicyclist, depending on their speed, isn't going to be able to stop nearly that quickly safely. Bicyclist averages between 12 and 14 miles an hour, and when you add in reaction time, it's going to be considerably longer, where a pedestrian can stop within literally a step after realizing they need to.
Representative Bernardi.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, I think you raise a good issue. I think we all believe a pedestrian should have this. I don't know, I can't speak for other people, but we would want pedestrians to have the same safety laws or even better than bicyclists have. And so I will look into that to find out if we need to get that into law as well. And I'd love to, like, do that bill with you.
Okay. Any further questions, Representative Corker? Positioning himself for a question.
Thank you for noticing, Mr. Chair. At the bottom of page 3, lines 3.29 to 3.31 have been struck, and they've been moved over to page 2, more or less lines 2.27 to 2.29. There's some changes there, and I'm curious why that language is moving and why it's been rewritten.
Okay, Mr.
Bernardi.
Chair Hornstein, could you please ask Mr. Burris that question?
I think he heard
that,
it.
That might have been his recommendation.
He's usually very alert, so I'm
right,
sure
yeah.
He was paying attention.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, that is a it's amended further with the other amendment, but it's primarily intended as a technical change to centralize the language around general rights and duties, which is the other language that's in current law in that subdivision one.
President Torkelson is contemplating that.
Well, okay.
Any follow-up or?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Berth. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Representative Petersburg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I will add a little clarification, too, because it changes from underneath riding rules to traffic laws. So does that mean that it gives it a little bit more validity in regards to enforcement, or is it just strictly technical?
Representative Petersburg, are you directing that to Mr. Burris? Or
Mr. Chair, I will rely that upon you to determine the person.
That's a good question, Representative Petersburg. I mean, the difference between rule and law. And Representative Bernardi, you were waiving.
Well, I was just going to say this was a recommendation from Mr. Burris, and I want it wherever it has the most protection and safety for bicyclists. So I would defer to Mr. Burris on his recommendation to do this.
Okay, we'll hear from Mr. Burris and then Representative Joachim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, I wouldn't say that the movement of it changes its level of validity or power. In both cases, it's in the same section of law. It would be moved to a different subdivision. The other thing I would note, just for the committee members to be aware, is that bolded traffic laws apply, and similarly, the bolded riding rules are headnotes and are
signposts that provide some indication as to what the content of those respective subdivisions are. There's actually a provision in the statutes outlining that doesn't have legal effect. So those are, you know, kind of intended as guidelines.
Thank you. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this is to Mr. Burris, too. These all still fall under the fact that a bicycle has to act like a part of traffic, even if it's on the shoulder, with this change, and isn't making it applied to the rules of a pedestrian or anybody else on the shoulder. Is that correct?
Mr. Burris.
Moving it over to the different subhead, that doesn't change. A bicycle still has to operate like it's a part of traffic.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, I think you've expressed it accurately, and you can see that language starting on 2.22, which is the current law requirement laying out rights and duties for bicyclists being the same as for other motorists. The distinction that's being added and modified and moved refers to crosswalk and pedestrian-like situations, essentially.
Yes, Representative Runbeck.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And on page, lines 4.5 and 4.6, that's new language. And, I mean, it will be understood and used by the biking community, but you wonder, it's going to really require the drivers, right, to know this law, because that's where there could be real problems. They're going to assume they're over there. Anyway, I'm sure you've confronted this before, and how's it going to work?
I can speak to that.
Yeah,
thanks. Yeah. Mr. Chair,
Officer.
Representative Runbeck and rest of the committee, the problem that happens quite often, especially on county roads, and I can tell you, you're from Anoka County, as am I, many of the Anoka County roads have beautiful shoulders for riding on, and then they merge into this wonderful right turn lane on a 45 or 50 mile an hour highway. What I'm required to do then is pull out into traffic, into the straight ahead lane in front of 50, 55 mile an hour traffic and hope they don't run me over. In reality, most cyclists, including myself, even though you're supposed to go right if you're using the right turn lane, I maintain my line, which is generally going to be what started out is just to the right side of the fog line, which now fades away. I maintain that line, and I end up in like the left one-third of that straight-through lane. And I think most vehicle operators, most motorists, understand what I'm doing. But it's also, under current law, illegal. And we're trying to make that legal in that particular situation. And it's mostly for those situations where the shoulder merges into or turns into a right-turn-only lane. It's not so much an urban traffic where, first of all, it's slower. You can ride in the straight-through lane with a lot more safety. But that's the main concern that I've heard, and that's the reason for it. And the language also dictates the right one-third. Mm-hmm. Typically, a cyclist, if they're going to make a right turn, they're going to be in the right side of that lane. So they're communicating visually with their position in the lane what their intention is. We couldn't think of a better way to deal with that situation than what we've come up with. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, that's what most of us are doing now, even though it's technically illegal.
Representative Runbeck, did you have a follow-up?
Joe, just a follow-up. So by the time you're in that right-hand turn lane, the car, the automobiles are also in that right-hand turn lane. You've basically merged.
Well, if there's a car in front of me, I'll stay to their left. If they're behind me, they can go where they want because I'm ahead of them. I've got the right of way. But I just stay in the left part of the right lane to go straight. I had that experience out on Bunker Lake one time. I was nearly run over by an Anoka County Highway plow truck that wouldn't let me into the lane, to be honest with you. So it you just comfortably just stay in the left side of that right turn only lane and go through. It's not worth the effort to fight with motorists that don't like it when you suddenly pull in front of them because of the law. They don't understand it.
Okay. Sorry. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the officer,
But bikes have to follow the same laws as cars. So if a car is in the right turn lane, the car still has to use its right turn signal. It still should signal its turn even if it's the right lane. Wouldn't that be true of a bike, too, that they would have to be signaling their turn?
Absolutely. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Okay, other additional discussion? Yes, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So going back to your earlier comments about the difference between the shoulder and the roadway, once you establish a right turn lane, does that part of the shoulder then become roadway?
That would be my interpretation, sir, yes.
So,
Representative Torkelson.
No, I'm
just going to clarify. Yeah, okay, good. Okay, is there any further discussion of House File 462 as amended? Seeing none, would you like to restate your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to renew my motion to have House File 462 be re-referred with recommendations to go to the General Register as amended.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. And members, as we have one more bill, Representative Hansen is a little delayed, but that's okay because Ms. Randall is here. But before she comes, I did want to let folks know that Senator Newman and I are working on a, I don't know what you'd call it, a skinny transportation policy bill or transportation policy select as opposed to transportation prime. And we're taking some of these types of provisions that we feel are non-controversial and then wrapping them up into a bill. So, you know, we'll continue to hear some of these bills, but I think maybe for efficiency's sake, particularly if they're non-controversial, I'll run this by you, Representative Torkelson. Maybe we could, you know, move those along. They were in the vetoed bill last year, and we can get those off of the agenda and then probably then do a new policy bill at that point. So that's partly what we're doing here. And then the other, while we're again waiting for Representative Hansen, I did want to just remind folks that on Thursday we have some guests from Georgia that will be testifying here at our committee about some work they've done on a bipartisan basis on transportation in that state. Next week, we will hear some more bills a week from today. And then it's my hope that on Thursday, the 14th, we'll have a hearing on some transportation issues as they relate to electrification of the transportation infrastructure. And then the following week, there will be, my understanding, this is the transition to you, another OLA report on MNLARS. And I don't know, Ms. Randall, when do you have a publication date on that yet at this point?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA. Yeah, we are planning to release our MNLARS special review on February 14th.
Okay.
In the evening.
So, members, it's our hope. We'll discuss with the OLA hearing that report then on the 19th. And, you know, those are the next several meetings we have. I know that Representative Torkelson did a good job of following those reports, and we'll continue in that tradition and use that opportunity also to dig a little deeper into some of the issues around MNLARS. So that's on February 19th. And then finally, we have our first field hearing, again, a reminder, on the 22nd in St. Cloud, and we will have we'll hear some bills from Representative O'Driscoll and Representative Wolgamont in front of their hometown. They'll have the home field advantage up there. And then the 26th, we have a field hearing that evening. Tuesday, the 26th, please hold the date for hearing in Minneapolis. We were originally going to do one in the North Metro, but one of our North Metro members couldn't make that, so we'll switch that day to a time that they can be there. And we should have a final list of all of these hearings available by the end of the week. And keep in mind, we also have Mankato on March 8th. So we finished our announcements, Ms. Randall. And just in terms of providing some context for why Ms. Randall is here and a little bit of background into House File 131, one of the items related to Menlars that the Office of the Legislative Auditor looked into late last year was the issue of were consumers impacted by some of the problems associated with Menlars? For example, were there mistakes made in charging people for their license tabs? And there were some important findings in that report, and I think House File 131 is aimed at compensating consumers who had problems with that system. And just, you know, by way of introduction, House File 131 will sit in committee. We're not going to move that along. There's no fiscal note. I think the bill does need a little bit more work. Representative Torkelson has pointed out some issues and I think is constructively working to note those, and so he has an amendment. We won't take action on that today either, but House File 131 is, I think, just meant to start a conversation about if and how and how much compensation would be appropriate for those who experience problems with the Menlars system, particularly with their license tabs being overcharged and in some cases undercharged. So, Ms. Randall, welcome to the committee. I think what would be helpful at this point is if you could just summarize your findings in this particular piece. Again, there's many aspects of Menlars that the OLA has looked at, but I think we'd like to just focus on this particular piece, which was in your report, which I believe was released in fall sometime last year. So welcome to the committee, and we look forward to hearing your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Judy Randall with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm hoping you all have a copy of the report in front of you. I believe it was in your packets. It was released in September of 2018. And as Chair Hornstein mentioned, it was kind of a deep dive into the transaction accuracy of Menlars. And as the Chair mentioned, we did have a number of findings, but I'll focus on the ones related to vehicle registration and base value, and that was in fact the area where we found the largest percentage of inaccuracies in the transactions that occurred in Menlars. What we discovered as we were digging into this is that the problems in calculating the registration tax is largely the result of the way a registration tax is calculated, which relies on something called the base value of a vehicle. So when you purchase a car, there's a couple of values that kind of get assigned to you in the system, or to that vehicle in the system. One is the MSRP, and then another is the destination charge. And those two items, the sum of those two items, make up what's called the base value. What we found was that about 40% of the base values for the sample we pulled were inaccurate. It's a pretty high number. It's a high rate of inaccuracy, even for us, where our job is to look for inaccuracies. So we tried to figure out, well, why? Why were there so many problems? And one of the main reasons is because the base value is kind of a moving target, actually, for about 6 months, maybe even a year. So the way Menlars is set up is that if the base value has been established, let's say the car has been out for 6 months or a year, the system can kind of go out into a table in Menlars, find the base value, pull it, and then it can run the calculations. If the base value has not yet been established by the manufacturer, the deputy registrar or the folks at DVS then have to find that base value somewhere else. And there's kind of a hierarchy of places they go to find the correct base value. They can go to a third-party vendor that collects that information. They can go to Blue Book. They can ultimately go to the dealer. But what this means is there's not one single source for this base value amount, again, for the first 6 months or a year that a car is sold. So I could go out, buy a brand new 2019, Honda Pilot, and go and register my car, and then Representative Rumbeck in a week could go do the same thing, and we might have different base values. So the problem then is that different people have basically the same vehicle model and make, but they end up getting charged a different amount in their tabs or the registration tax because it's based on the base value. If you turn to page 12 in the report, I think this is really the best example of the problem and one that I think captured a lot of imagination when we released the report. What we did when we were doing this work is we looked for some outliers. We looked for certain makes and models of vehicles that seem to have a really big range of base value. And the 2018 Ford F-150 pickup truck is one that really jumped out at us. What we found in Minlars is that one owner of that vehicle had a base value of $2 for the pickup. And then you can see the range, and it went up to almost $70,000 of a base value for that same vehicle. What that meant is that those two people were paying significantly different amounts in their registration tax. We were able to determine what we thought was kind of the true base value amount, and it was around $39,000. Ironically, no vehicles in the system were assigned that base value. But you can see the spread in Exhibit 1.4. You can see the range of base values there. So what this means is that, again, people are paying significantly different amounts in registration tax. The other curious thing in law is that there is a law that prohibits somebody from paying more in registration tax than was ever paid on that vehicle previously. So the person who has that $2 base value gets 10 years of a discount. I raise that. I don't think that this bill is necessarily addressing that quirk in law, although I think there are some amendments. So what we found, again, is that there were a significant number of inaccuracies. I cannot tell you precisely what percentage of people were overcharged and what percentage of people were undercharged. We were not able to extrapolate that from the way our sample was pulled. We can simply extrapolate that about 40% of folks were paying the wrong amount. Mr. Chair, that's kind of the high-level discussion related to this finding and these issues. I'm happy to talk about other things, but that kind of captures it.
Thank you very much, Ms. Randall. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Torkelson, and then Representative Elkins after that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being with us again today. Ms. Randall, appreciate all the work that's gone into Minlars from a variety of angles. Since this report was first issued, you had some time to present it to a variety of folks, I'm sure, and a chance to think about it. Any further thoughts on how we can adjust our system so that it is more accurate and more timely and doesn't have the high number of errors that you discovered in your report?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, thank you for the question. I think there are a couple of different approaches that the legislature could think about. One is more radical than House File 131, and that's to move away from using base value. What we have been told and what I believe to be true is that it will take 6 months to a year for base value to kind of settle down to one value. So if we want to kind of have people being taxed on a number we feel confident about, then one approach is to move away from base value. There's other ways you could do it. Different states do it based on sales price or on weight. So things that are kind of set in stone there. The thought about weight is that part of this, this money is supposed to be used then to help fix roads and build roads and bridges, and so the weight may be something that affects roads more than the price of a car, but there's different approaches there. Another approach, if we want to stay with base value, is to authorize and require the department a year later to go in and correct and say a year post, we can now say, okay, here's the true 2018 base value for all these different makes and models. We're going to go in, adjust the system, and change the law to allow people to pay more, than they previously paid, and clearly explain that
the first year is kind of a roll of the dice, frankly, but thereafter then we have the true value, and then we'll move forward with that. So those are a couple of different options. I'm sure as many people are in the room, there are ideas, but those are some of the ones that have come to us.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for that, Ms. Randall. You know, when you go to the car dealer, there's a sticker on the window that gives you some numbers that have been generated by the manufacturer. Do those change over time? Is that part of the issue here?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, yes. Our understanding is that those do change. Also, the way the base value is calculated in Minnesota law, it's not based on trim line or options. It's in law, it's stated as the lowest MSRP, then plus this destination charge. So that sticker window price is a different amount than that lowest MSRP plus destination charge.
Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, as I'm thinking about this, and a lot of this is new to me, but it seems like this is really more of a data sourcing issue than a systems or an application issue, per se. Am I correct?
Ms. Randall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, yes. Related to this issue in particular, most of the inaccuracies we found were because there were not good, reliable base value data. Now, there were some other findings we had related to some coding and some user error issues, but this one, the majority of it, you're correct, is due to bad data.
So,
Representative Elkins?
Would a simpler solution be for us to base this off the purchase price rather than a value that we have trouble obtaining from the manufacturers?
Ms. Randall, I know this actually was raised when you presented your report back whenever we heard it, and I think Representative Torkelson brought you in at that point. Comment, I refresh my memory on that.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins, it would simplify it in terms of people knowing what they're supposed to be taxed on, and, you know, there's a receipt and it's a very clear amount. You know, one of the concerns we had with using base value is that people who own the exact same vehicle are being taxed different amounts. If you base it on sales price, you will probably still have some variability, depending on people's negotiation skills, perhaps, or other things. And so I think it's up for the legislature to think about what are you all comfortable with, you know, in terms of that variability and what that variability is based on. I don't know that variability is necessarily bad. We felt that the way the tax was constructed now, based on this base value, and it was supposed to be the lowest base value that was out there, that variability was not a good thing. But if you are willing to accept using sales price and understanding that there will be some variability, then that's certainly one way to go.
And Ms. Randall, wasn't this, I'm again recalling back to that hearing we had in fall, wasn't this in statute in the 90s at some point? Is that kind of what we're dealing with law from back then? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. This isn't a new problem. This isn't a new problem to Minlars, frankly.
Thank you. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, you just answered my one question I had. It's not a new problem to Minlars. And then Representative Elkins covered some of it, too. It sounds like this is more of an issue with manufacturing transparency and pricing set at that level. So that's another conversation.
Okay. Representative Richardson, did you have a question?
It was more of a comment than a question in terms of thinking about the variability of sales prices and wondering what that impact would look like for women and also for people of color in terms of if there are going to be disparities in those prices.
So a good point. Do you have any thoughts or comments? Okay. Are there any other questions for Ms. Randall? Yes, Representative Torkelson.
Well, I'll just point out that if we do go to sales price, then we are abandoning the kind of notion that we are taxing the base value of the vehicle. The sales price would, of course, include all the bells and whistles that we currently do not include in our calculations. That may or may not be valid, but it certainly would be one of the effects of going to a sales price approach to this.
Good point. Any other questions, thoughts? We do very much appreciate your being here. Perhaps, I don't know what your schedule's like, if you could stick around maybe through Representative Hansen's testimony, there might be some additional questions or areas in which we would like your input. So my understanding is that Representative Hansen will be here momentarily. We'll just recess for a couple of minutes until he makes his way down here. So we stand in recess till Representative Hansen comes. I'd like to reconvene the Transportation Finance and Policy Division and welcome Chair Hansen to the committee. And Representative Hansen, we did hear an overview already from Ms. Randall, so that's been taken care of. And I will just move to lay House File 131 over for possible inclusion in a future bill concerning MNLARS or transportation finance bill. We're at this point holding the MNLARS bills in our committee, and we'll take action once we're clear on other needs. And I know you have a bill that we'll likely hear next week as well. So welcome to the committee, and we'd like to hear from Representative Hansen on House File 131.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I apologize, I was tied up across the hallway there. And I understand you've heard from the legislative auditor, and the rationale for the bill came, I believe, from the Audit Commission report last fall and the quarterly oversight committee meetings where Representative Torkelson and yourself as chair were at that. So there were folks who the audit, as you've heard, paid too much, and what we're trying to do is correct that problem with House File 131. I think, I don't know if you've had testimony from DPS, but I think they will say that they are going to have difficulties determining that. I do have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment, I believe, which is the one to bring it up to concurrent dates. I actually had the bill drafted last fall and jacketed last fall.
Well, Representative Hansen was moving quickly on this
one. I had it done in October, and I found that this is a bill that people are very interested in. Wherever they live, they want to make sure that they're back. If they paid too much, that they would get a reimbursement. So if you could adopt the A2 amendment, that would be great.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Discussion of the A2 amendment. This is just an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that Representative Hansen would like us to consider it in. Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see in the A2 amendment on lines 1.9 and 1.10 that there are two blank appropriation numbers. Are we going to fill those in now or at a future date?
Representative Nelson, we will fill those in at a future date. We don't have a fiscal note for this bill, and it will be, I think, a challenge to make some calculations. But, there's probably a series of bills that the legislature will need to make some appropriations on related to MNLARS. And so I think that would be part of the grouping. And also, just to ground members, if you have your audit report on page 50, bullet point number 6 is a recommendation from the legislative auditor. DPS and legislature should consider reimbursing customers where known errant collections were made. And so I think Representative Hansen's bill addresses that. And so the question, Representative Nelson, is figuring out what those reimbursements are. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, as I look at this and I read it, again, we're actually putting a dollar amount into the bill. There were the blank part on the bill, we're putting a dollar amount in there.
Yeah.
I read it backwards.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment, I estimated $2 million and 10% for the administrative costs, just as a ballpark figure. So that's okay. You can change that in the future. I thought it might be good to have something to start with.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Representative Nelson. again, you know, this will require a fiscal note. This is a fiscal guess, but a fiscal note would be forthcoming, and that's one of the reasons we're holding this in committee. And the second reason we're holding it in committee is that I think we kind of want to get a sense of the broader situation with Minlars. There's deputy registrar reimbursements, possibly towers, possibly auto dealers, possibly and likely an allocation to DPS and Minute for their needs moving forward. So there's a variety of fiscal matters concerning Minlars. But, you know, Representative Hansen, I respect your judgment here, and in terms of at least putting in these numbers, it does help give us a baseline. So that's where we're going here. All right. All in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. The motion prevails. And Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill as amended. We're dealing with vehicle registration transaction data. You heard from the legislative auditor the materials there. We're directing the DPS to work on record keeping, submit a summary of data to the steering committee, have public outreach about the call center, you know, if people are interested in checking on whether they repay or paid too much or not, and then calculating out that each of those tasks are significant. I think if we inform folks, often the story flares back up in the media whenever there's a story about this, and there will be another audit coming up, and I think Minnesotans are going to ask, did I pay too much? And then the question is, if I paid too much, will I be getting that back? So that's where a little summary of the bill.
Okay, questions of the author? Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question is, does this bill have any place in it, the fact that once it was recalculated, oftentimes it gets put into the system at that rate from moving forward? Is there a place in here where Minlars is then also supposed to go back and correct the proper value for these vehicles so that it is correct from this point forward?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Petersburg. As you know, correcting the live system has been a challenge, and I think that would be something we would hope that it would be corrected. And I think the fiscal note should take that into account. But that's probably the bill next week that we're going to hear as operations continue to evolve on Minlars. But the logical question is, there should be my intent here, this is a one-time correction, and that system is correct so it doesn't keep making the mistake when you renew that.
Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. I just what triggered my memory was Ms. Randall said that once your value was put in, the system keeps you from paying more tax the following year than you did before, which indicates that the system has kind of a memory into that. And I just want to make sure that when we do these one-time corrections, that we're also correcting the system so that the miscalculation doesn't occur in the future, even though we've corrected it in the past. And that's.
Thank you, Representative. Representative O'Driscoll.
And thank you,
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, I don't know if you have the answer to this question, but the current line of questioning and discussion by the committee gives me pause to ask this question. Will the overpayment of fees go to the payor, or will it go to the person who's entitled in the vehicle at the time that the tabs are issued for renewal for the next cycle?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, I don't have an answer to that right now. Obviously, things move, so I think my intent would be the person who's made that payment at that moment, that transaction, that we're correcting that transaction. Now, I may have done that on December 31st and then sold you the car a month later, but the correction, that would be a different. So when you're keeping the contemporaneous record of the transactions, if that transaction was off, then that's between you and the Minlars. That would be the second correction, if that's what I'm interpreting your
Representative O'Driscoll.
It's not a two trains leave a station kind of question. Where do they meet and where do they pass from algebra class? It's just something that if I realize we're trying to get it back to the taxpayer, to the consumer, which is the right thing to do on that. But it becomes a question of who's entitled in the vehicle, and we're probably not talking about hundreds of dollars on a vehicle. We're probably talking about dollars or tens of dollars, maybe on the high side on it. Just kind of curious to see how that's going to be addressed. I suspect consumers are going to have a question about, is it me who's entitled in the vehicle at that point because we're just going to do the correction and reduce tabs the next year, or are we actually going to go through a bureaucratic issuing of checks and those kinds of things, or are we, as you suggested, we know there's a chain of who had that vehicle. Are we going to go back to that snapshot in time, who the payor was, and then issue them a check? I don't know if we have the answer. It's something that I think it probably needs to be fine-tuned and considered in your bill.
Thank you for those comments, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize we're just about out of time, and I know this bill is going to be discussed in more detail as we move through the process. We'll be informed by some more information that we're going to get. But just a quick question, Representative Hansen. Say that you are one of these people who paid too much, but you paid too much based on a base value that was too low. Are you going to accommodate that?
Representative Hansen, this is you're addressing the F-150 owners of the across the state of Minnesota.
The if you go to Subdivision 3, Representative Torkelson, the Commissioner of Public Safety must establish a reimbursement calculation to refund or credit motor vehicle owners that overpaid the taxes and fees for the vehicle registration as identified by the analysis performed under Subdivision 1. And we'll go back to that analysis. The Commissioner of Public Safety must compile and analyze all those transactions to determine the amount actually paid by the owner for each transaction exceeded the amount required for the transaction. So if it's the amount required for the transaction and there was an error in that base value calculation, that should be taken into account because, again, you're back to exceed the amount required. So my intent there is required is what should be the actual amount with an accurate base value calculation.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. We may want to clarify the language, but if that's your intent, that's helpful.
Okay, we'll have time for one more question from Representative Hausman, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just more statement of anxiety about unintended consequences. When I've just been listening to the conversation today, including the earlier one about determining the value, and what there's a part of me that wonders whether we're, without questions answered, whether we are handing an impossible task to the department, and on top of some of the other work that they are doing, I worry that we're going to bog them down in what is a very complicated and controversial potential.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I worry about that as well. I mean, this is I've met with DPS, and I think that with this bill here, that this is not the end of this bill. The net goal here is to try to find some way of correcting an error for Minnesotans, and that I've, after spending a year and a half on these Minlars issues, I'm fully aware that it's a journey, that not a sprint, and that just when you think you're done with that journey, it continues. So I think this will continue. I'm happy to work with the committee and the agency to try to find some way of helping Minnesotans who may have paid too much, and that we do that in an administratively easier way.
Thank you. And I do want to just thank you, Representative Hansen, for the work you've done, Representative Torkelson, for the work that you've done and both of you continue to do on this issue. We have a lot of good experts in the room, and as well as the Department of Public Safety. So, this is, as Representative Hansen said, the beginning of a conversation about this bill and what we can do for Minnesotans that felt that they were wrong through this process. And we will, and with that, I will renew the motion to lay this bill over for later discussion and possible inclusion in a future finance bill. Members, with that, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much for your attention and your work today.